My name is Scott Stender. I'm a principal partner with ISEC Partners. I was one of the founders of the company, and I'm based out of Seattle. I work as mostly a security consultant in our application consulting practice today. And I'm here with Alex Vittergaard.
Thank you, Scott. I am Alex Vittergaard, and I am also a security consultant with ISEC Partners. Mostly we do all kinds of application, sometimes network penetration testing, et cetera. But what we find to be particularly interesting is the application side of things. And that led us down this particular rabbit path, which we will get started on.
All right. Well, our topic here today is concurrency attacks and web applications. So better stay away from that microphone over there. Concurrency attacks and web applications. We're going to run through a quick overview of what concurrency is, how it applies to web servers and applications. Talk about types of flaws that you might find that are based in concurrency, and then go through different approaches to fix it at the design layer and the implementation layer, and then also finish off with some guidance on how to test for these things. We're also fully demoed, and we're a little bit insane because they're all live, including live compilation of code. So you have to bear with us, I'm sure, with the hiccups that will come. But the topic of this talk is really not a zero-day we're dropping on the world. It's not that this type of flaw isn't well-known in the security space. It's that this type of flaw is not very well-covered in the web application security space. As part of putting together this proposal for this talk, we did a search all over Google for different resources on concurrency attacks. It's something that we were aware of, that we had tried out in our own testing, but we didn't see a lot of evangelization of this type of flaw. So, we're not going to pretend that we invented this type of flaw, but we are hoping to give better coverage of it than we've seen in the public anywhere else. We hope to give people the design guidance that they need in order to fix their systems and some test tools to help find flaws in their own stuff. And the one thing I will say, though, about previous work on the subject is right about a month ago, I got an email from a gentleman in Italy who did a talk or a presentation on this as part of his PhD thesis at the University of Milan. So, very cool that somebody else is doing some work on this, and I recommend you find his white paper and check it out. So, with that, we'll do a very brief introduction to concurrency. Now, concurrency, some of the feedback I got from my coworkers when they saw this was it's a very big, long word, very familiar to a lot of computer science majors. But really, concurrency is, you know, something that we often refer to under the banner of multi-threading or something along those lines. And the types of flaws you find when it go wrong, we call concurrency flaws, but really they have names like race conditions, time of check, time of use, all kinds of manners, things that sometimes apply to different scenarios differently. We bundle them all up into a high-level thing of concurrency is what we're worried about, and concurrency flaws are what we're trying to find. Now, concurrency refers to the ability of a system to execute multiple threads of execution concurrently. I mentioned the little quotation marks here because it's not quite concurrent. What you're looking for a lot of times is the impression of concurrency. The only thing that can run an actual thread of execution on a CPU is a CPU core, and as we all know, we have maybe 1, 2, 4, 64 cores for those of you that have a lot of extra hardware budget. But on a given machine, you'll usually find many more than 64 threads of execution, which depending on the operating system you use, might be a thread, like in Windows, but in some versions of Unix, it's a process. We kind of, again, for terminology purposes, just call it all thread. On a single application, concurrency buys you a couple of things. It buys you the ability to go and start trying to do something, and if you have to wait on something slow, like disk access or network request, then you can go and do something else interesting. And again, that's two threads of execution. So you increase responsiveness and performance of your application. Across systems or across threads of execution, it gives you the ability to split your time and focus across a lot of different things, and so you can put more information or more code on one entity. Again, this is all pretty good basic stuff I hope everybody here is familiar with. So what does it take to handle multiple threads of execution? Well, I put them all into one, four different criteria here. You need a way to define them, a thread-based function. As a programmer, what you do is you define a function that's going to be the first thing that a thread does when it starts up, and that's the, programming API approach to it. You also have to have a way to manage them. So you might have some stuff that's at the programming language layer that kind of looks like a thread, and you might have some APIs that deal with that. Typically, operating systems provide functionality that allows you to create and maintain threads of execution. So you can start them, stop them, freeze them, schedule them, all that good stuff. You have to have a way to share data between threads, because in isolation, they're not very useful. So that's where shared memory and IPC comes from, or is helpful. And they need a way to synchronize access to data across them. Now, there's the rub. That's what the core of our entire talk is about, is that when you have sensitive data that must be shared by different threads of execution, you have to be very smart about how you access it. And when you're not smart about it and you have a security issue, then that's where a concurrency flaw comes from. But all this sounds complicated. Well, it is. And that's why we see a whole lot of problems with concurrent systems. They're difficult to design. They're difficult to implement, and they're very difficult to test. And so when we find something like this, that a lot of people have difficulty doing this, and there's some security-sensitive impact to that, then that's where a lot of security flaws come from. And another thing I'll say is that web applications are particularly difficult here, because a lot of times what the web application developer gets is a very simple API that masks a lot of complexity, and especially a lot of complexity about the data that's being managed by each thread. So that little bit of shielding of complexity plus all the difficulty in all this means that we believe that web applications are particularly prone to concurrency flaws, and people have not been looking at them very carefully. So there's the theme of our talk. I'll hand it over to Alex to give a little bit more introduction on how they work in web apps.
All right. Well, we've kind of talked about what a thread is, how it's going to work. How do people, though, use these, and how they become part of what it is that we're trying to do. So just to start real simple, we look at a web server. Essentially, it is a simple web server is just going to have one thread that maybe accepts a request to that web server, generates some kind of response to that request, and then sends that back to the user. So I go to a website, that thread processes me, it finds out what I need and gives it back to me, and I'm happy. But in reality, an easier way to process lots of those requests is to have lots of threads. So a lot of those threads are going to split the time, process all of those requests from lots of different people, generate some kind of response. Maybe they go talk to a database. Maybe they query some process somewhere else, get information, and then send that back to the users when that information is available. In terms of efficiency, it uses a lot more resources to have lots of threads because we're passing information back and forth. But what it does is it provides kind of a smoother user experience, because a lot of those different users can be processed more or less at the same time. Concurrency, once again. What Scott alluded to there is that we have our web server, and then there's an application that's going to be running on that web server. And so this is when things start to become a little bit more complicated, because we're writing an application that's going to be processed. Maybe we don't know necessarily how it's going to be processed by all those different threads of execution, which I believe... Here we go. So some of the frameworks that exist are the ones that we're going to use, or we used for our demos, are Java Struts, Java Struts 2, and the .NET framework. Those are two different technologies which have taken kind of the complexity of what's going on behind the scenes, taken all that threading, and wrapped it up into a nice wrapper, and here I am, a programmer. All I need to do is provide this framework a function. And I write a function. The classic example is the hello world, right? I write a function that just says, print out hello world. And the framework is going to take that, and if 10,000 people access my website at once, somewhere maybe 30 or 40 threads are going to take that, get the output of that function, and spit it out to those users. But as a developer, I may not have to consider all the little intricacies of what's going on with all the threads. I just need to worry about the interface to it, which is my framework, which is what we looked at once again was Java Struts and .NET. So for our demonstration, we are going to start real simple. We basically just have a simple bank transfer application, right? So we've created a bank and might be interesting or valuable to transfer money from one account in that bank to a second account in that bank. And what our demos are going to be running on .NET today. But once we have that program, that functionality established, the first thing that you generally do is some type of functional testing. So we will, actually this is probably a good time to get the demo started. So basic functionality again, the part that we're probably not going to show you is the logon. So it's going to do a logon kind of behind the scenes. And then we're going to have an interface that allows us to select from the accounts available, select a source account, a destination account, and the amount that we want to transfer from one of those accounts to the other. Real basic functionality, and we're just demonstrating a basic functional test of that web app. And then don't worry, the concurrency issues come into play a little bit later. We're just keeping it simple.
All right, well, as Alex said, we're assimilating a very small part of a bank. When you go to the default bank, it will do a little quick login behind the scenes and query your account balance for the accounts that you own. So here, the user that's logged on has account ID 1 and 2. Each has a balance of $1 million because this is Vegas. And we'll see that the total balance at the bottom is $2 million. If we want to, we have one bit of functionality we can do here. We can start with the source account and destination account, and we can transfer $1 between both of them, between these two accounts that we own. When we hit transfer, we'll see the transfer was successful, and our total balance is still $2 million, as we would hope when we're just transferring between accounts of our own. And sure enough, when we go back there, we see that one account has a dollar more than the others. We're going to revisit this this website several times through, but hopefully have a quick idea of what it does. Now, if we were to do functional tests, what kind of things might you throw at this? We have, obviously, this request is going to contain a source account, a destination account, and an amount to transfer. So those of us that are familiar with with security attacks might try more than just transferring money between one account to another. We might start trying things like apostrophe or, less than things. We want to find a cross-site scripting maybe, and maybe an amount that just is completely gibberish. And we'll transfer that, and we'll see that actually nothing goes through. It'll just validate, and if the data isn't proper, it'll come back, and we'll have a chance to open or throw in different amounts. If we want to, say, try to make sure that we can't transfer more money than we actually own, I might try to transfer $1,002,000 and see how that happens. And it says, oh, actually, I can't transfer more money than I have. So I still have a total balance of $2 million, and we still have all that. Maybe I want to try to do more security testing. Maybe I want to try account ID number 3, one I don't own, and transfer money to myself. Oh, I can't do that. I'm not the owner of the logged on user. So there's a pretty decent functional test here. We know that it works. We tried a couple of negative tests. What haven't we tried? Any questions, any ideas from the audience here? All right. Negative numbers. Good idea. Let's try that. Oops. Oh, amount transfer should be greater than 0. Okay, it looks like whoever this programmer was did a pretty decent job on most things. Is there anything else that we might want to find here? How about stress testing? Everybody does stress tests when they build a system. We want to make sure that we can handle a lot of concurrent clients, right? Let's say this bank expects that we're going to have 200 clients at a given time. We want to make sure that the actual throughput on the database, the web server, everything else can support that. So we're a pretty good test team. We're doing functional, we're doing positive, negative, and now we're doing stress tests. This is not so bad. So here we have a tool that we wrote, and we will release once I can sync up to the network. And it's called Sync Test. And what it does is it will simulate a lot of clients. Each client will be represented as a single thread of execution within this Python program. And I feed it requests, and it will just keep on spinning on those requests as many times as I say to do it. And I also have configured this one so it'll do it in bursts. So I can say, all 200 threads, fire 5 seconds from now, and try to really mess up things, then fire again 5 seconds later. Or it can just be a big, huge mess and go after it as quickly as it can. So here I've taken the logon. The logon request. I'm going to play that from 200 simultaneous clients, and we're going to run that 5 times. So here we go. And it'll say, you're about to do 1,000 requests, crazy person. Are you sure? So then it'll go through, start up all the requests, and if we go back over here to the server, server's running here in a VM, we will see that, let me get rid of this here. Oh. Didn't mean to hit that one. What we'll see is the CPU starts spiking. We'll start seeing. So what I have here, just to go through the different things we record, because we'll be looking at these a lot. I have total processor time being used on this machine. I have the percent of processor time being used by the database process, the thread count on the database process, the total processor time being used by the web server, and then the thread count on the web server. And so what we'll hope to see when we do these things is those different metrics go and bump up any time we start doing stress tests. We saw here this was a pretty decent app. When we hit it with 200 simultaneous requests 5 times in a row, there wasn't any appreciable change of the worker pool or anything else like that. We just saw the CPU spike a little bit. No big deal. And we saw that with that the parameters of that test, we had about 33 requests per second go through. So there we go. So there's our, we've tested this site pretty thoroughly and given you a quick introduction of what a functional test site or a functional test might look like. Let's look at the code and see what people are actually doing here. So here is the account class that I have, and it has a little manager here that will actually transfer funds. And we can see that, sure enough, it does a whole lot of data validation. It checks to see if the amount is less than zero. It'll get the account out of the database, check to make sure it's valid, check to make sure the logged on user is the owner of the account, make sure that there's enough money in the account to do the transfer. If all that checks out, it'll get the destination account, check to make sure it's valid, and then update the balances. So there's our transaction. That's how we transfer money. We'll see how maybe there's one problem in here. And if you look at the title of this talk, maybe you'll have a hint as to what it is. And we'll go through a few different ways in which that will manifest now. Any questions so far? Keep them coming if you do. All right. So I think it's...
This one's mine? All right. Very good. All right. So we have our function, once again, that Scotty just went through, that it pretty robustly tests all of our input. And so we're going to run it in a situation where lots of threads are going to be processing that. And so is it really predictable of how that's going to operate? Kind of. It depends kind of on a lot of things. That particular function is doing a database call. So it kind of depends on the database that's going on. It also is doing, or that's running on his system that has a particular version of the IIS server running on it for the web app. So how that's going to process the threads, how his CPU operating system is going to decide when it's done operating on one thread and when it's time to move on to another. All of these things kind of create uncertainty on how that particular function is going to operate, especially when there's lots of it being run at simultaneous or concurrent times.
You have the button.
I do have the button. All right. Here I am, a programmer again. What am I going to do? I'm going to use my framework. And so frameworks are going to protect us from these things, right? Well,
might
maybe.
Think so.
If I was a betting man, I wouldn't say so. But so during the course of our research, we kind of came up with some interesting quotes from the different manuals or books about some of these technologies. Actually, the start of this idea in Scott's head came from this O'Reilly book about struts that he came across
a few years ago.
A couple years ago. A nice, big, thick book talked about everything that you need to know about struts, but it had this one little paragraph on one page that talked about what you need to do and worry about when it comes to multithreading. And so... I'm not going to read it to you, but it's interesting that it basically puts this one little caveat. He's like, hey, this isn't really a thread-safe environment, and weird things can happen that are really hard to track down, but be careful. I'm going to move on to the other 1,000 pages of the book now. So there are other things that are in place to help protect you, things like Hibernate, which is a plugin that'll talk to the database with you. Itself, once again, it has this little caveat in here. It recommends spending some time with your JDBC and ANSI specifications so that you know what transaction levels and things are going on. So it's like, all right, I guess I can't just use this Hibernate to solve my issues. Struts 2, they have this awesome statement. They said, well, hey, we don't have to worry about concurrency issues because we just make a new version of each of our class and it just runs on its own. And that's cool. Like, it does actually operate on its own and it works fine, but as soon as anything needs to transfer, any data needs to transfer between one thread and another, well then, uh-oh, we're not really thread safe anymore because we need to coordinate that information. As long as it's running in isolation, it can be happy, and it's thread safe, but not necessarily once you start coordinating things. And Things like Java have things that will help protect you against this if you know that you need to implement them, there aren't any requirements for that. So I can write an application, just like Scott just demonstrated, that functionally perfect, but maybe it's not concurrently perfect.
And the big takeaway, and this is what struck me when I was reading that first book, is that there's all this focus on functionality, and they just kind of expect that you'll notice that little thing about, thread safety, not so much. And then they just punt everything over to the programmer, saying no guidance or anything like that. If you want to get really esoteric, you can go buy a whole bunch of very theoretical books on design patterns for concurrent systems or things like that. But the books that every programmer who wants to actually develop these frameworks must read just kind of punt and say, that's somebody else's problem. And maybe yours or your money's. So,
all right. So for this, we're just going to show a quick kind of a verbal description of what the program that we just showed does. This is just pseudocode. Basically, it's the very simple transfer funds. It's going to take the account balance, make sure that there's enough money in that balance to make a transfer. It's going to then very simplistic, once again, it's going to update the destination and update the source. And if this can operate it by itself in that isolation, it's fine. But as soon as there's multiple things executing at the same time, we kind of get unexpected results. And to visualize that, this slide, basically we take... this is as if two threads are operating simultaneously on a processor. So thread one, it's going to check the source amount. So this is a variable that it's using to control how the operation of this function works. Then, mysteriously, or maybe predictably, something decides that that thread no longer is important and it needs to move on to the next thread. And that could be the operating system. It could be the web app server. Either way, it's decided to move on to the other thread, and that thread, once again, grabs that information, grabs the control, and starts processing. This time, rather than moving on to another thread, it gets to complete the execution of that function. Now, it's time to move back onto the first thread. The first thread starts doing its information. But it's now that the other thread has completed, thread one is now working on some dirty data, so information that's already been updated by the other thread. And this is the very heart of what a concurrency flaw is in an application, is when one function is operating on information that gets modified by another function or method. So if we go to the right column of that slide, you'll notice that the numbers at the bottom don't quite add up right. At the start, we have $10 in both accounts, and we're transferring a dollar from one to the other. Ultimately, we should probably still end up with $20, right? But if we look, 9 plus 12, last time I checked, wasn't 20. And mysteriously or magically, either a dollar was created in this process. And that's because of dirty information being used by one of those threads.
Any questions about that? All right.
All right.
All right, so now we have another demo. And sure enough, we talked about what things people might have missed with our very robust and well-tested application before. Sure enough, there was a purposeful concurrency flaw in there, and we're going to shift around here a little bit on the tool so that we pull in different requests and send those over and over and over again. What this tool is now configured to do is spawn each thread, have each thread log on to the machine. It has it's captured the request and actually does the log on, get a unique session identifier, and then each thread just hammers with the unique session on the server, and we'll talk about why the log on is important a little bit later. So let's go back to our friend here and verify that, sure, indeed, it still is $2 million. And we're going to fix it up here. Source account, destination account. Oops. And now we have $1 million even in both of our accounts. So let's go ahead and start this thing off here. Again, 200 concurrent threads making 5 individual requests. I'm going to bet that it won't take long for us to see the problem. We start off all these guys again, and we start seeing that the Oh, all those little metrics are starting to pop up again. We have all the CPU hitting. We have all kinds of good things. Oh, and there's our worker threads for the web process or web server are starting to pop up. When you really hit this thing hard, it'll actually go up about another 50% beyond here. But you can see that as it sees it, more and more loads coming in, it keeps on spawning threads to handle that. And so goodness is happening down there. And we've had our request execute. And they're all finished up, and you can see there's no more CPU, and if we were to keep on looking here, this little thing, the thread pool would go down. Ah, sure enough. So now let's see, moment of truth. We've now lost $9. So based off of the rather simple request that we've been doing, we haven't been trying to time it for moving the dollars one way or another, so you have about a 50% chance on each time of having it go down or up. Sometimes we see it go up, and actually it depends a whole lot on the implementation of the function itself. Based off of, you know, where you put your selects and where you put your updates and that transfer funds, you'll start seeing the timing, encourage things one way or another. But certainly if we wanted to, take somebody's money, then this is a great way of doing it. If we wanted to say, counteract the risk of inflation in this country, hey, we've just done it. If we wanted money for ourselves, we might, time things just a little bit different so that we got more money ourselves. So there is the concurrency flaw in action, and if we were to go back to that pseudocode that that Alex just explained in depth, even though I have a bit more of the validation in here, it's pretty much the same thing. It gets a source account, it checks to make sure it has enough amount of to actually transfer in there, it gets a destination account later on, and then it makes sure that that account is valid, then it updates the new balances, and with that many threads doing the same thing at the same time, they just step over each other all the time, sure enough, we have concurrency flaws. Now this is a standard example in the world of concurrent programming. If you look at the real world examples people cite, it's either going to be withdrawing money from your bank account or transferring funds. But really, it's any kind of stateful action. If you want to roll back the clock, it's helpful to do something like this. Any questions on the demo? I know it's a big room. We'll have a chance for the microphone questions later on. All right. Well, then let's move back to the slides. So.
Is it you or me after this one?
All right, I think it's my turn here.
Very good.
All right. So how might you protect against this? Well, generally the process, by that I don't mean the threat of execution or the actual running process on whatever operating system we're using, but the process of transferring funds needs to be considered a single transaction, an atomic unit that is isolated from anything else going on that actually will go forward and either fail as a whole or succeed as a whole. Shared values, such as the balance, should be protected during execution. And indeed, it wasn't here. You saw nothing that would protect it. No references to locks and no references to transactions. And sure enough, that's our problem. So there's many options that we can consider. We can use those thread synchronization things, or we could maybe use some database features, but we'll go into those in detail here. Once again, as I said before, this class of flaws is well known, and if you're a kernel developer, this is the stuff you live and breathe by, because when you get it wrong, you see bad, crashes and kernel panics and things like that. Here in the web application world, they're a little bit more subtle. Let's say you had a concurrency flaw that only affected something that was a session variable, so it's something that a single logged on user could execute against themselves. Now, if that's a balance, hey, sure, they want to execute that. But it's really hard to, you're not going to have a whole lot of common scenarios where you have 1,000 individual browsers hitting a web server at the same time from your test, from your test organization. They're very subtle, they're very hard to find, and even with very sophisticated testing environments, I personally in my, in my previous career had found very subtle yet devastating security flaws, or concurrency flaws. So it's something that there isn't the great tool set, there isn't the great set of practices in the web world, and so we've found that they're pretty prevalent. So what makes a bug in synchronization a security flaw? I mean, I've seen things that are devastating, but they weren't always a security flaw. Now, devastating, obviously, denial of service is something. If we can manipulate internal state or something like that, or make it so that things are so poorly performant that it can't possibly work anymore, that's obviously a denial of service security flaw. A lot of the higher value ones, and I'm saying denial of service is a low value thing in general, but you also have assets. If you can manipulate an asset with a concurrency flaw, then that's where the big money is, including the money here. So if any time you have something that is a stateful asset you want to roll back, any time you can control a transaction in this way, then that's, you know, that's really what we would say are the big high-priority security flaws that would plague web application systems. And it's not just money. It's not just things like that. It could be an authentication system where, say, you know, you have a write taken away from you, and if you can put that write back onto you by using a concurrency flaw, then that's a good thing. Or if you're, say, if you're a Safari user, anywhere you use Safari books online out there? I do it so I don't have a whole bunch of paper on my shelf. But they give you little tokens that you can download things from time to time. So you can download chapters of books and bring them on the plane with you. If I could request two such, you know, PDFs at one time and then I was only charged one, hey, there's a security flaw. Not quite money, but it's the kind of thing that you might, that they would care about. Key takeaway is, though, look for those stateful assets and see how people can manipulate them. And if they can, that's a security bug, and put that into your risk modeling, your threat modeling, whatever you want to call it. So frameworks themselves protect against concurrency flaws in a way. Sometimes they have to work together. Sometimes they have to work with other systems. So let's think about the design considerations you must consider when you're trying to protect against these things as you're going through the different frameworks. So first of all, let's just say we have a standalone web application, no backend systems, no other server that has to deal with. The framework actually provides quite a bit. You not only have all the synchronization primitives that come from the underlying language, you might also have help from the web application framework specifically. One good example is .NET. When building a version of this same site that relied on session variables to manipulate or to store balance information, I found the .NET had absolutely no concurrency flaws, and it's because actually requests are serialized in .NET per session ID. And so, sure enough, I could do, you know, a million requests against my .NET server, but if I use the same session ID for each one, they would just go in line. Even with a really horribly poorly implemented system, I had no discrepancy in that $2 million at the end. So that's one way in which a framework can help you. Of course, Struts 2, as we saw earlier with a couple of warnings, doesn't do that same action. It does do some things to help protect you against concurrency flaws, like between the Strut 1.x and 2.x, they started spawning instances of actions rather than relying on singletons. And that kind of thing made it so that for some instances it was protected against concurrency flaws where it was not previously. Anything you want to mention on that? Okay. All right, so there's within one application, very simple, one framework, no problem. Now what happens if we have two applications that have to speak with one another? Now we have to start to work with another system. We have to figure out who's first, who gets access to that data, who gets to lock against it, and we can't often rely on the programming constructs. That's where it starts to get really, really nasty. There's all these external standards which are very difficult to use. Thankfully, again, a lot of modern programming environments give you some transaction capability. But the most common scenario along those lines is a framework plus a database. This is what we're using right here. We have to synchronize access between my program that we wrote and the database that actually holds that data. Now, there's a couple of different approaches, and we're going to go through some demos on the pros and cons of those. One difficult thing there is, let's say we can synchronize between the framework and the database at the framework level. What happens when another application comes along and starts using the database? And that's framework plus database. Now we have to have the database in charge of a whole lot of things. And what happens if we have a replicated database or something like that? Now we really get into a pretty technology-specific, you know, deep end that we really have to understand, test, and verify in order to make sure that we have some sort of security assurance. Next. All right. So let's focus on just within the application. That first scenario, we're in the framework, we have a shared resource, maybe it's a session variable or something else that's in memory. How do we protect against concurrency flaws in there? Let's say our initial design is to query our data store to service a user request and allow the user to modify that. This is basically what we demoed a moment ago, except for there was a back-end database doing it. But we just have a very, very silly type of just, yeah, you know, take the request, manipulate it, don't try to do any synchronization. Of course, we're going to have a flaw. So now here's the, you know, so people say, okay, how do I fix that? Your developer, your tester comes to you and says, hey, I found this really crazy thing. 1 out of 1,000 times, it completely messes up the internal state of the system. What's the deal? And they say, oh, okay, now you know what I'll do? Is let's say I knew that there was a balance of $10 in there before, and then I do my transaction to adjust balances. Before I write it back, I'm going to make sure it hasn't changed real quick. That way I know that nobody else has stepped on my toes and I'll be okay. Now, what that will do is it'll close the window, It means that if you're going to actually have a flaw, you know, you're going to have to re-enter right into in between those two statements of that last check before that last update. But there's still a window. It's actually, if you look at the instructions on the CPU, it's a rather large window, and it's even a window you might be able to manipulate as an attacker. But what you will probably do is make it so that you can no longer repro it on a standard system. You might not be able to repro it on your bench. You might be able, your test team might be able to run the same script again and not find the bug. But the bug is still there, and it's going to be much more likely to manifest itself when you are on a, you know, very large multi-core OS or soft piece of hardware. So there we go. We can't just shut the window without closing it all the way. So how can we do that? We'll use a synchronization primitive. We'll put a big global lock in there. We'll make it so that anybody who is going to manipulate the data store is going to have to acquire a handle to this lock, do their changes, and then release it. Now that will work. It'll serialize just about everything that happens in your web application, but it will do so at the price of serializing everything that goes on in your web application. All the benefits of concurrency will no longer happen, so you can't just go global and use a big sledgehammer. What you often want to do is have a scope block, something that is specific and well thought out and well designed that will only protect the resources you need while allowing other people to use other parts of the data store or read if what you really care about is write and things like that. So let's do a quick demo on how that might look. A moment ago, we saw the very basic transfer funds function with no sort of checking for concurrency. And get rid of this here. Now we have transfer funds lock. And I know you aren't as familiar with the code as I am, but it is exactly the same thing, except for now we pass this thing called TX lock into the function. And one of the first things we do, at the latest possible moment, is we acquire a handle to that lock, and then we do all of that last minute checking of the amount, get the account and verify the owner and all that good stuff, and then we do the update. Those things were the actual read and write to the data store, and that's our minimum set of transaction that we want to protect. So what we do is we have the base class for the web page, transferfunds.aspx. We'll create a singleton or a static variable, a lock, and it'll pass that to the function when it's being run. So all these different threads are going off this class are referring to the same scoped lock that is specific to this request. So it stays still quite performant, but it does not have the problems that the other version did. And sure enough, we'll do our live recompile to the same test over again. So here we had transfer funds. Comment that sucker out. Uncomment transfer funds lock. A little build. Okay. Not too insane here. And we publish. So sure enough, we come back here. Actually, we'll go ahead and reset the balance of all those accounts. Come on.
So while Scott's fixing the database real quick, just to reiterate what this demo is going to show is that it's locking at the application layer. So he's taking that function, which is the same as the pseudocode that I showed at the beginning, but instead of allowing it to execute willy-nilly as each thread comes in, it's just putting a lock and saying, hey, if a thread wants to execute this, make sure that nobody else is using this particular section of code first. And so what that's going to do is it's hopefully going to prevent that data from being accessed by multiple threads and prevent dirty access from being updated to the database.
All right. Thank you for that intro. So sure enough, if we run this here, it'll do the same 2,000 in requests or changes or requests and change. We'll come back not too long after. We'll see our little spikes, which my VM did not very much like having to close Notepad, so it's already kind of stressed. But if we go back over here to did not like being updated there. So if we look back here, we'll see that we're still at about 2 million, and if we keep on requesting updates, we'll stay right there at 2 million, and we'll find that, sure enough, it was locked to the application layer, that sensitive transaction was protected, and everything is happy. Unfortunately, my CPU probably decided to go find Windows Update at the time.
So this is actually a good example of how you can't really tell, like, predictably what's going on. Right now, his operating system decided to go do something else, and so it didn't happen to be running that particular thread. Bad for live demos.
But I assure you, it worked about 1,000 times this morning. All right, well, I hope that you all will trust and believe that this is indeed what happened. We can move on from here.
Okay, so the next logical progression then of how to resolve this, since we demonstrated, or you're believing that we're demonstrating how to fix it at the application layer, is to push it down to ways to fix it at the database layer. Once again, looking at the initial design, if you're just allowing updates and queries whenever a thread wants to, you're going to end up running into problems. Say you want to do that same problem or resolve it again by just checking at the very last second, hey, let's query the database, and if it is known information, then we'll update. Once again, you still have that window that Scott spoke of, and if you have enough threads executing, enough things going on, that window can open up and you have a concurrency issue. One interesting thing is, say we only update the database with a known value. So we're going to update our update SQL statement's going to say, okay, only update the account balance if it is this value, and update it to this new value. Surprisingly, sometimes that doesn't work because of some of the things that are going on. Maybe once again, it is using basically old data, or there's cached information somewhere between your application and the database. So what are we going to do? Well, we could just use one connection to the database and make all of our little threads use that one connection, and then we'll serialize it on that. Same problem as before. If you're going to bottleneck everything to one spot, you're going to run into some problems. And there's, once again, no guarantee that unless you're synchronizing with your application, that data and those queries and updates are going to be in the right order, or the intended order of your functionality. So what do? You use this transactions is what they're called. Basically, you're going to take your database engine will basically allow transactions to happen, rollbacks to happen. It will do the ordering of your queries and updates according to very strict rules. How does it know what these rules are, or how does it know you just want to read, or how it's going to allow you to do things to it? Well, you have to tell it. And that's sometimes easier said than done, because you have to look into what are the requirements or things like that. And that gets into the topic of isolation levels of your transactions to your transactional database. And so in order to start synchronizing things, you need to look at your data. You need to determine if you're just going to look at that data for informational purposes. For this, maybe we're just doing a query of our accounts, and we just want to know how many dollars that we have. So we have the $2 million. We just want to make sure it's there every night, so we do a query. Is it okay to lock on that? It's probably okay to lock the database on that query, but what's going to end up happening is if other things want to happen during that lock, they're going to get blocked out. So maybe a lower isolation level is going to be more appropriate for that. Whereas when you're doing those critical types of applications, like updating account, transferring funds from one account to another, that's when you need to be more careful, and you need to raise the isolation level to a level that's going to lock the database, or lock those records, and only allow information to be read that is current or up to date, preventing that kind of dirty update of information. The key thing here is to atomize your transaction to the database. So if you can maintain the integrity of the read, the update, and then commit without allowing anything to break up that atom, then you've done something good, and that can be handled with transactions. A lot of databases will you might hear the acronym ACID, and that's, are they atomic? Concurrent, what their isolation is, and their durability, and things like that. So depending on what database that you decided to integrate into your web application, these are some of the considerations of those transactions. And one quick and easy way to fix your code is if you look and it's easy to dissect your transaction into separate parts, it's probably not a good atom. And you probably need to look at it and decide where a transaction is going to be appropriate or where multiple transactions might be appropriate. All right, and how do you do that? Wow, that's a good lead-in, right? So you look at the data that your application is using. Do you need to read it? Read it just for purposes of finding if you still have that normal balance. Do you need to update it? Do you need to be able to delete a record? These are all different considerations into what isolation level your database is going to be, or more importantly, what the connection and queries that you're going to submit to your database are going to be returned as. And is it important that you get those queries right away? So, for example, say Scott and I share an account, and I'm at home refreshing every minute because I like to see that I have $100 in my account, and Scott wants to go and transfer that. If we've locked everything, then, well, maybe Scott can't look at that right now because I'm sitting at home refreshing every minute or every second. So that's a service that we service level that we need to consider as a design criteria for what our application is going to provide for us. So these are just considerations for the data and the application that aren't necessarily inherent in what the framework is providing. It just says, hey, produce an application and we'll run it. And then you have to take into consideration is that the data and the connections itself.
Mm-hmm. One thing to say is the number of ways that this can go wrong is very, very, very long. Think about the set of every application that could be written. With all the different ways we've thrown out that synchronization can be achieved through operating system primitives, framework APIs that maybe use those or abstract them. Or re-implement them in a user mode specific way. Think about all the ways in which you can interact with the database, and then there's a whole set of other servers we haven't even given a nod to yet. Let's say you want to integrate with your back-end web service or your Kix mainframe or any number of other things. You have to find a way to synchronize access to that core data, whether it's in your application, whether it's in another server, and you have to make sure that all the consumers are able to synchronize access there, and it gets very, very, very ugly. So just remember to when you find that data that Alex was giving the constraints on and all that good stuff, when you find that, understand where it's stored, understand who the consumers are, and then understand the technologies at your disposal and use the right tool for the job. A lot of times, if you can keep it simple, you're going to be much better off. If you have to go into a wide-ranging, very distributed system, the main protocol that you can use for that sort of thing is the XA protocol. Almost every database server implements it. A lot of operating systems have native support for it. There's a lot of external servers that you can use to help coordinate such things, like JTS for Java, MTS, or MSDTC is a component on Windows that does the same thing. But the idea is that you basically make everybody subscribe to a two-phase commit where everybody does all the interesting work, and then later on they come back around and say, yes, I really am ready to go. All that was successful and do it. Now, all that sounds very complicated and slow, and it is, which is why you want to stay away from it as much as you can and architect your systems to be resilient against this, and simplicity is key to that. And to kind of illustrate that example, we're going to go back to that same bit of code, which, hey, maybe it's still running, not. My web server is not entirely happy right now. I'm going to go ahead and do a quick little reset on it. I knew that the live demos were crazy.
This is the transaction, right?
This is what?
Transactions.
Yep.
Okay, while Scotty's tinkering, I'll go ahead and just give us a quick rundown of what this demo is going to do. So kind of to mirror the previous demo, if you recall, it solved the problem in the application layer and by putting the locks in. And then I went into how transactions are important to look at. And so for this particular demo, using the same functionality of that transfer funds function, this time instead of doing an application lock, though, it adds database transactions. And it we carefully inspected the isolation level to make sure that it was appropriate. Then we will demonstrate that it is, in fact, secure. Mm-hmm. Based on this particular test.
All right, so the one thing I want to demo with this code is to push all the all the synchronization handling down to the database. No, you know, synchronization primitives used in this function, nothing else. You can see that the function definition here is exactly the same as the other one. It's just called TXN. Now, in order to do this, I had to do a few things that kind of fit with the theme of our story here. One is that you saw that the code was rather clean and simple before. I just said, get a count. And that get a count would take an ID and go off to the database and do the query, initialize a class and return that back up to the calling function with a well-defined API that was very easy to use. It made for very compact, maintainable, well-understood code. And it used a lot of object-oriented programming's finest moments by using encapsulation to encapsulate all that complexity of where the data is and how it's pulled out and what the nitty-gritty details are. As far as the transfer funds function was concerned, it was give me an account, adjust the balance, get rid of it. Now, in order to do a transaction, I have to understand what all those little nitty-gritty pieces of data are underneath the covers. I have to break that encapsulation in effect. There are a couple different approaches I could do. I could associate a higher level connection with a transaction associated with it with, say, my thread. And that way, any data access that happened within that thread would be associated with an atomic transaction. There are products that do this. They're a little bit insane. Another thing I could do is actually pass a transaction identifier or a handle to a database connection that was transaction sensitive down to all those things. But again, that takes a dependence on passing state and data between the layers, which is not really what we're trying to do with data encapsulation. It's kind of wonky. So what I had to do is actually break all that, take the functions that I had defined and pull them up there so that I can define a single database connection, which if we look up here, we can see that I do that here. And then I have to, in the way transactions are the API-centric way of doing it in .NET, is to create your database connection, then say connection, begin transaction. And that's where you specify your isolation level. And I'll go back to some of our adventures in isolation level in a moment here. Then you create a command, and then you use that same command to do everything else you want to do. So you can see I'm doing command execute reader for get my, get account information, update account information, all that good stuff through here. If everything goes well, at the end I say commit my transaction and close the connection. If things go badly, if I catch an exception, either one I threw or one that the dependent functions threw, then I say roll back the transaction, do not transfer money, do not pass go, get rid of it all, we'll go back to where we were. And then again I do some cleanup and I close. So this is a way of pushing everything down to the database, but as we'll see if we do this demo again, it does not work very well. And that's where some of the adventures of transactions come in. Now let's see if this works.
It works well to maintain the integrity of the database, but
yes.
It does not necessarily work well as a good quality of service application.
There is the last demo. If you recall, I forgot to do a little bit of recompiling. But you now see all the happy spikes from the burst that I talked about a moment ago, and it all works still. But what I need to do here is actually...
It's actually fairly convenient that he ran that, in that it's interesting to compare the two. When just the way that the processes get executed and how much CPU time are used between the normal application lock versus the database transaction levels.
Yep.
And we'll get into why that is in a sec.
So you can see, as I said before, the tool does things in bursts. So you can see the CPU going up and down when that happens. And that's exactly what we want to see. And as we saw when I came back after that thing was all finished running, we indeed do still have $2 million around. Everything is happy. Only half the requests went in one way and the other way. But sure enough, we have integrity of the amount of money left over. Now if we run this tool again with the newly published database transaction only part of things, and we have publish succeeded, and I run that same test, we go back over here, what are we going to see? We're going to see a first spike, and then we should see another spike, and we kind of do, and then it should kind of tail off here in a moment. That is if I did get my publish here. So what we see here are a couple of things. Number one, CPU has kind of stopped. It's going down pretty low, but our thread count on the worker process is way up. It was about 20 when idle, now it's 31. So there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of threads are trying to work, but nothing is happening. Well, what we just saw was a deadlock. And if we were to look at the output from all these things, we'd see that a fair number of the requests just failed because of a deadlock. Now, there are good and bad reasons for why that occurs. Number one, we talked about all the difficulty of getting your isolation level right. We will see if I go up to the top here that I said my begin transaction with an isolation level of serializable. Now, that is the most conservative, most ridiculous one to put. It's the kind of thing that if you put that on there, some database admin will come over and hit you on the head. Reason why is because it actually locks rows so that nobody else can write to them when until you're done with them. Nobody else can mess with them. I mean, it's a pretty conservative way of locking rows. However, the default that you're to use, if you're just to say begin transaction without a value, is what's called read committed, and that means that my transaction can read committed information from other transactions, so things other transactions have completed, but I won't necessarily prevent other people from changing them midway. So when I first implemented this here, I did not put an argument there, ran the same thing, and after all my test threads were done, I found that there was still a synchronization problem. Even though I'm using these database transactions, it was because the isolation level was off. And in order to get this thing right, I have to set this isolation level so high that it actually is causing all kinds of deadlocks. And in order to remove those, I'd have to use a combination of application synchronization and also manipulate the transaction a little bit so that I could remove the ability for threads to deadlock on each other. But what I have made is a pretty nasty denial of service condition. But what we will see when it actually does come back, which should be a little while here, is that I'm still at $2 million. So I've, 10 minutes left. So I have $2 million still. I've introduced a denial of service, and I've proven why people have that lower isolation level by default, but I do have a lot of work to do yet. But that's what happens when you push it solely to the database and don't do any kind of synchronization otherwise. Now, what I would do if I were to fix this for real is I would go through and make sure that when a user is manipulating their own data, that I would put those in line, or I'd change the transaction such that we would reduce the likelihood of deadlocks. Right now, what happens if it hits a deadlock, it'll hit a timeout, one of the deadlock threads will win, and the transaction will continue. It's just very, very slow. So there is our last demo here. And there's my PowerPoint. Next one, Jerry.
Yeah, I think you were going to...
Sure enough. All right, so finding concurrency flaws. So we've gone through what concurrency is. We've, I think, proven that concurrency flaws can exist, and they're actually rather easy to come across. I hope, maybe, that we've also convinced you that the kind of encapsulation that is inherent in the object-oriented web application frameworks makes it so that maybe it's hard to find those shared pieces of data. Maybe you've just inherited a library and somebody else has given it to you and you don't know what it's encapsulating, and yet you have to be responsible for serializing access to that. That's all pretty tough stuff. And then once you're done with implementing it, we've got to find those things. So we'll go over a couple of quick strategies to help you find concurrency flaws and finish up with some Q&A. So finding concurrency flaws. Now, if you have access to code and documentation, you might be able to go the formal approach. You identify all that shared data, stuff that you know about and also stuff that your encapsulated classes knows about. Identify all the access to that data from shared systems. You have to find all those information consumers, whether it's your application, your peer applications. You have to make sure that all of them play nice together on that shared piece of data. So if people don't get that right, you do a few thousand requests against any one of those information consumers, and then there's your profit. Now, not so fast. The technologies involved are numerous and complicated. I just made it sound like it was pretty easy to go and find those concurrency flaws. Hey, I just look at the code. If I don't see anything that says lock, or if I don't see anything that says semaphore, mutex, or anything else like that, then I know they have synchronization problems. Not so fast. We also have the transactional way. So if I were to do this in database access, I would have to look for that and SQL transaction. Or somebody is using their own XA protocol compliant system. They have some funky API I've never seen before. You have to understand at a deep level what the high level architecture of the system is, how they seek to put this out, and it's going to be very technology specific, rather difficult to find. So that would be the code review approach. Now then, there's a testing approach. Now, testing for concurrency and synchronization flaws is very difficult. There is no single fire and forget test. You can't do a, one time, yes, I transferred money, I have a positive test result, I'm good to go, because it's all probabilistic. It is very likely that of the four demos we did, one of them would fail, not because it simply didn't work like that third demo, but because probabilistically it's ended up right back where it started off. And if you are, you know, working in systems that, you know, for some reason your test environment does not show enough window of opportunity, or your testing style doesn't do it, or let's say it's like, you know, you one very easy mistake to make with this flaw or this tool I made here was to just simply make all of your requests using the same session ID. If I didn't do that first login and pull in another session ID, we wouldn't see a single concurrency flaw on this ASP.NET-based server because it would all be serialized. So you really have to broaden your perspective, you know, understand what's going on underneath the covers, and try various different ways, and hope that at one point you'll find that the system catches up, or has a little catch to it. And the biggest catch you look for is looking for discrepancies. So what we look for on here is we just write off all the output from the server that we got and look for some time that said your transfer is something other than $2 million. Another thing you can't really rely on is stress testing, as we showed with that first demo. Stress testing is, you know, designed to find out how many transactions per second you can handle, or maybe give a rough estimate of how many clients you have. Directed security testing for concurrency flaws is much more difficult. You have to find those assets. You have to find the different ways in which they can be manipulated. You have to find all those consumers and find one of them that's not doing something right. If you're an attacker, the odds are on your side. We have this tool that we've been demoing here. It's just been a very simple capture and replay request type of tool. It'll be available on the isecpartners.com website/tools once, like I said, I have a chance to sync up to the internet. But it should be there within the week. And acknowledgments, many thanks to Jesse Burns and Brad Hill of ISEC. I can see Jesse right over there. They're very helpful in bouncing off ideas along all these different technologies that are involved, and have been very supportive of our research. And also, as I said before, there's that gentleman over in Italy who just wrote a paper on it, and so I'd check that out too. So questions and answers, we have about a little less than 5 minutes. Please come to the microphones and feel free to direct them our way.
Just a quick question on your demo you gave where you came up with a result of 12. just applying that, how, in practice, how do you actually account for and reconcile, you know, the concurrency flaw? You know, you gave a pretty basic example, but
yep,
if you're dealing with a lot of transactions, I think I would get lost just trying to sort through all that manually. Is there any kind of tools or any kind of, you know, method that you'd recommend?
And there are, you know, formal methods for proving access to data. And if you look at the white paper that's on the CD here, there's a very large and academic tome about formal proofs of such things. But really, you know, what you pointed out there was that when you have such complicated systems with so many different consumers, and that's just, you know, trying to test for one transaction or one access to, you know, inappropriate access to data, it really does get overwhelming. There is no tool that can take care of all that for you, and I'm skeptical that one could be created for the general case. But what we do is, as part of our, you know, when we do an assessment, we kind of go through a risk modeling or threat modeling. There's all sorts of different names associated with it today. But you know, trying to identify those candidate transactions and candidate pieces of data and trying to go after those.
Another quick question. How
yes.
random was that input, you know, that you were giving to the parameters? Was it the same input? I mean, you were using different session, it seems, obviously. But.
What the tool does is you can optionally say, just go off and, you know, here's a logon request, go play that, pull out the cookie, and then insert it into the transaction request that you also define. The only thing that changes in those transaction requests is the cookie, the session identifier for login purposes. And again, that's specifically because you know, some things rely on, you know, will serialize across a given session ID. The parameters of that request were all the same. It was just transferring $1 between account 1 and 2, and then $1 back from 2 to 1.
So that's maybe one way to keep things straight, I guess, when you're doing your testing, if you have the same, you know, parameters and you notice a discrepancy in the concurrency.
Oh, I see what you're asking. Yeah, absolutely. It's it'd be very helpful if you could run a million tests, you know, as quickly as you can, and then come back and realize that yes, my balances are exactly where they started. You know, you might find that maybe a couple of transfers fail, but the key thing that you look for is, you know, some indication that internal state is consistent. My, you know, account balance is $2 million, or if it were say an authorization scheme, I still have access to this file, or I no longer have access to this file, something along those lines.
Okay, just thanks. A quick interjection on that too is that final state is a good check, but probably not necessarily sufficient, because state may have gotten right. messed up along the way.
Right, in the middle or something like that. And that. But in the end, you may end up with the correct amount. Or have you seen that before?
I can't say that I've witnessed that happening. Maybe I have, and I just thought my test wasn't working.
Okay. Thanks.
But yeah, and actually, one of the things the tool also helps is you can output the results of every single request. What it does do is it takes away some performance and just serializes, because you have to serialize on output, all of your threads from the client. But if you do that, you'll get a whole lot of data, but you will be able to check at each stage, oh, it went from 2 million down to 1,999,000, and then it came back up to 2 million over time.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Anything else? All right, well, thank you all for your time and coming out to see us. We'll be up here if you have questions or just a little bit shy on the microphones. And if you have any questions, come now or take a card and email us later. Thank you all.